Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Michael Footer.
And I'm Amanda Farrow.
In each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. And we have an excellent industry pro with us today.
We really do. Today we are joined by Carrie Toyama, who is the lead producer on Disintegration, which is coming out super soon. And she works with Private Division. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
It's so wonderful to talk with you again. Carrie and I originally had a conversation like 2 years ago at a leadership conference of all places. And I just knew that if I ever wanted to talk producer language, I'd go find Carrie. And here we are.
Here we are. Excellent. Here we are. So we always like to kick off these interviews. And this is Amanda's special way of launching into interviews. And I love it. And we started doing it on Virtual Economy. And that is, we want to know what your origin story is and how you got started in the industry.
This is an amazing origin story. So you like definitely buckle up.
I think we should tell the origin story like three times, and then every time we'll add something different to it.
it's like the ninth gate. You need all three books.
Wow, that is an esoteric reference.
Okay, all right, we got this.
We do.
I started essentially in my early 20s. Most of the beginnings started before I was 21, so I was really young. I was going to school going to college during the day, and working at a grocery store at night. And so I was actually had nothing to do with the game industry at the time. I wanted to. I was studying to be a police officer here in Seattle. I'm originally from Hawaii, but I've been in Seattle for the last 16 years or so. The reason why I wanted to be a police officer is because I really loved social work, but I also wanted to get paid well and have a future. Mm-hmm. And I loved being outside.
That's fair.
So I thought that at the time that being a police officer would kind of like marry those two things, being a public servant and also, you know, being outside and being able to talk to people. I'm very glad that I didn't make that choice, but I do think that I probably would have been an okay police officer. Who knows?
I believe
still
it.
Glad I didn't do that.
I'm also glad you didn't do that, because then we wouldn't have this amazing origin story and career path to talk through.
That's true. Although maybe I would have been like that nerdy police officer that like went viral on like BuzzFeed or something. You know? I don't know.
Life goals.
Yeah, right. Since I worked at night and I went to school during the day, I had like a really weird, not normal schedule. So all of my free time, I actually spent playing Halo 2, and started like becoming a part of the communities there. One in particular was an all-woman group called the Cave Girls. There was about 30 of us. We had like our little clan on Bungie.net and a forum and a community with just us. And it was only girls allowed at the time.
Only Cave Girls allowed.
Only Cave Girls allowed. We let one boy in there once.
Once, and that was it. And he was gone after that.
Like a joke. Yeah. Fun times.
If you've ever seen me play Halo, a joke is actually an appropriate way to describe it.
Oh my goodness.
I managed to shoot myself full of needles.
How did... You know what? I'm not going to even ask. I'm not going there.
You're standing in front of a wall or something?
I don't know. I just... It's not good. It's real bad.
It's like
I've played so much Halo and I never get better.
It's like a self-own, but a self-frag. That's nice.
Oh, I like that.
I just
like
stickied that. Myself.
You just stickied
like,
yourself.
Threw a grenade at the ground, like at my leg. Hello, guys. Yep.
We've all been there. We've all been there.
No, it's true. We have all been there.
Yeah. No, I really loved being a part of the communities there, especially the Cave Girls. It was, a lot of people have this story, but it was a sense of a community that I didn't have in real life and that I desperately needed at that time. You know, I was going through a lot, and those people really, man, they helped me. They, I mean, I would say that Halo really, like, changed my life, probably saved my life in some cases. It sounds a little dramatic, but I think a lot of people have that. Like,
yeah.
I've heard a lot of people say that about that game, and other games too, but, you know, there was that, man, we would sit in those, like, pre-game, post-game lobbies together and just chat for, like, you know, hours and hours, and, you know, those people really helped me, and so it became, like, just like it became part of my life, part of my lifestyle, and then I realized that, the developers were actually, like, really close by. They were in Kirkland, and I lived in Seattle. It was, like, I lived near Seattle. Mm-hmm. I don't know. They're about, like, 25 minutes away from me, and I was like,
oh, what? That's not bad.
Yeah. I was like, I didn't even know anything about game development. I didn't know about game dev studios. I didn't know who made games, but I was like, wow, this is super cool. And, like, and we played with a lot of the community people and the developers, designers, a lot, because at the time, Bungie was small enough that they could really spend a lot of time playing with their community.
Mm-hmm.
And they especially loved playing with the communities that weren't very toxic, as you would. And we were one of those. But, you know, they took our feedback. Like, they would do, like, you know, sort of polls with us and help us, like, kind of shape the, you know, the sort of, like, live ops aspect. They didn't call it then at the time, call it that then at the time, but it was really that, you know, like, you know, we influenced, like, what game types they, you know, they put live in the hoppers and things like that. Super fun.
That's awesome.
Yeah, actually, you know, I did have this story that they, there wasn't, in Halo 2, there was no option to change the Spartan voice in multiplayer to a female voice. It was always a male voice. And they actually asked us if we would be interested, if they added a female voice option, would we even use it? And they actually asked us, like, in private. It wasn't even, like, a public thing that they did. And at the time, of course, I was like, whoa, we're so important. They care about our feelings. This is so cool. And we actually, like, man, we put together a pretty thoughtful response, because some of the people in our group were like, I don't care about that. And most of us, I think, did. But we, like, really put together this, like, thoughtful response, had our own, like, forum post on it. And
I love
presented
that.
Them with an answer. Yeah, we thought we were so cool. And that's
that
why
is
the,
cool.
They added it to the game. So that was really neat.
That's amazing.
So stuff like that, you know, it was super cool. And I went to a PAX. It was the only PAX at the time. In 2005, that was my first one. It wasn't even at the convention center. I don't even know how many people attended, but it was at a very small convention center in Bellevue. I think I did count at the time. I was like one of four women in the whole building. I also remember the Nintendo. Was it the DS or 3DS that had just come out in 2005?
Is the DS?
DS. Okay. Yeah. Someone. I was standing in line to play in a Halo tournament, and this guy in front of me, I don't know how old he was very young, he was playing on a DS, and I had not seen one before, and I was like, oh, that's so cool, you know, so I, like, I think I remember, like, asking him, like, oh, do you like it, like, is it cool, or, he turned around, and he just, like, grunted at me, saying any words, and I was like, oh, okay, that's what this place is gonna be like. I'm so glad that PAX is not like that anymore, but
it really isn't.
Gotta start somewhere.
Yeah, true. It's like the evolution of man, that picture, you know, it's like, as it, like, goes from, like, Cro-Magnon all the way, like, to walking upright, and then hunched over a phone again.
Yes.
But it's like, you have to start with grunts, I guess, before you get to welcome home.
It's definitely the PAX motto now, is welcome home.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
And it feels like wonderful. Home.
It does, you know, it's very open and welcoming, and there's something for everyone, but they really had to start with those dank nerds. Like, they made it. I was into it. Even though it was weird for me, I was like, whatever, it's fine. And so I got to meet a bunch of the Bungie devs that I had been, you know, playing video games with for a long time, and that was awesome. And then there at that PAX, I was also introduced to some folks from Ubisoft through the Halo community, and they were doing a casting call for the Frag Dolls. And we had to do, like, these, like, video interviews. Like, they just had a camera there, and they're like, if you're interested in this, then come do, like, this little video interview, introduce yourself, and tell us more about yourself and you know, your gaming life. And I was, I made top eight. I think they had, like, a couple hundred people from the U.S.
That's pretty good.
At least it's what they said. They probably just, like, I think they were going around to, like, MLG tournaments and stuff like that.
Okay.
So, yeah, so I made top eight, and then they flew us out to San Rafael, I believe it was THQ Studios, and they did this, like, game trailers, like, reality TV show series that it was, like, six episodes or something like that. Very embarrassing. really, really glad the footage doesn't exist.
Oh, anymore. Man. Otherwise, we would definitely link to it in the show notes. Oh,
God. This is a Robin Sparkles moment.
From How I Met Your Mother? Yeah. That's amazing.
They made us, like, we had, like, blogs. It was, like, a MySpace page, but on, like, GameTrailers.com.
What?
I looked at it, like, a few years ago to see if it still existed, because I was looking for the footage, and, like, my blog was horrible. It was horrible. I was embarrassed, because I was, like, 21. I was so young, and it was just, like, I think I said something about, like, oh, I don't have a boyfriend right now, but, like, I'm also not looking. Like, what the? What were we doing? Anyway.
It was a different time. It was really a different time.
It's humbling, because I'm so, that is not me anymore.
Can you imagine, like, anybody writing that on social right now?
Ah, you know, kids.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Our no, kid, perhaps. Our eldest, who's 16.
Maybe. Yeah.
Oh. No, but I have to remember where I came from, right? Like, you gotta remember.
True.
You gotta remember those roots. And those roots, they be dank.
Hey, I was I was in a specific environment, and that environment raised me, and it was a weird time in video game life. So,
2005 was a weird time.
It really was. But yeah, so I didn't make it. I didn't make the final cut. But it was awesome. It was an awesome experience. It opened a lot of doors for me, which was super cool. I got to meet a lot of people, and more importantly, I think, you know, I got to be a part of a group of women who, and their community, who really rallied around them, which was very rare at the time. It just wasn't a thing that happened. It was usually just more toxic than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still friends with quite a few of them. And we still talk, and it's really fun to see all of those women, where they are today. They're in really great places. Most of them are still in the industry or connected to it in some way, but they're all just doing really, really well, and I'm, like, super proud of that. I think that's really fun to see. They kind of opened some doors for me. They sent me to E3 2006.
Oh, wow.
What?
And that was before, so they were just like, even though we didn't win, they were like, hey, if you want to help us, like, you know, do demos at the Ubisoft booth during E3, we'll fly you there and we'll put you up in a hotel, and you basically, you know, it's like, then you work, but
sure,
we'll pay for your flight and your hotel. Like, of course I was going to say yes to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to my first E3, and it was so awesome, just like everyone's, you know, first E3 story. I was like, what is this, you know?
Yes.
And it was awesome. It was so cool. And I love seeing today, I love watching people experience that for the first time, which I don't know if we'll be able to do that anymore, but that's been a joy for me, where I'm like, haha, so cute, pat pat, but also I know what this is like, and it's so cool.
That was me in 2010, so I definitely, nice. I remember. Yeah.
You know, that 2006 show was the first show that they banned booth girls.
Oh.
Booth babes. That was also actually kind of strange, because you know, we weren't technically booth babes, because we were there because we played games.
Yeah, of course.
We were also, you know, working the booths and doing something similar. I mean, we were doing demos, you know, but some of the booth babes do demos too. Like, it was really weird. And so, like, a lot of the girls were picketing outside. And then we would go in, walk through their, like, little picket line. And they actually had, like, signs and everything.
Ooh, that's intense.
We would go in. Yeah, it was, like, really, it was very strange, but I was 21, so I was like, haha, this is adorable. But yeah, anyway, so I got to do that, and then I continued to talk to my Bungie friends, and they started hiring entry level testers, contract testers for Halo 3, and they had just announced it. I think they had announced it right before that 2006. Or during that 2006 show, mm-hmm. something like that. I can't remember exactly, but it was in development and people knew about it. And so I applied, but I don't have any, I don't have any industry experience. I'm still in college. I'm working at a grocery store at night. Like, I don't have anything. And so what I did was I had, my regular resume, but at the bottom, of course, it's a one pager at the time. It had nothing on it. At the bottom, I had this whole game section where I put the frag dolls on there. I was running a online charity tournament for in Halo 2 called Fight Like a Girl, and it benefited breast and cervical cancer research every October. I did that through the Cave Girls, and that was super fun. That's a long story too, but that really, like, it meant that I was able to, like, be a part of a community and run a project, things like that. So, and then I also had my Halo 2 stats, because Bungie.net had and still has all of your, like, stats.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Let's not look at mine. Ever.
Oh, I'm 100% going to go look yours
don't,
up.
Don't do that.
That's awesome.
I think it's now Halo Waypoint, but I think Bungie.net still has some legacy stuff there. And so it showed that I had played 6,000 matches of Halo 2.
Wow.
At the time. And so I was like, well, I pulled out all of the data that I thought was, like, interesting and, I don't know, kind of stood out. Because it was like, this is how much I love your game, this is all I have for you. And so I put it on there, and through the community, they some of the folks that worked at Bungie through the community and some of the designers, they actually put my resume on the desk of the test manager. At the time. So I would never have even been considered, my resume was wild. So,
it was unique.
It was unique.
It got people's attention. I'm telling you, this is what people need to be hearing, that you got to stand out.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I think, and I tell people that story if they want me to look at an entry level resume, I tell them to put that stuff in there. I'm like, why should you be considered for this? If you have something in there, you don't have any experience, actual experience, and put the stuff that you think is relevant in there, and make it stand out, because it doesn't hurt. If you don't do it properly, it can hurt. I think, like, a lot of people, I've seen resumes where they just, like, list all of the games that they participated in the beta for. And I'm like, I don't think that really. I mean, you have to go a little bit further than that.
It's awesome
that you participate in these betas, but what else are you contributing to those?
Mm-hmm.
So, for sure. And I think you just have to, like.
It's not the same as it used to be, where it was really hard to get into betas, and it was, back in the day, like, at that time, especially if you were in a beta, like, if you managed to get selected for a beta, it was a huge deal.
Now it was.
Like, that's true.
Pre-order the game, get into the closed beta or the open beta.
And I mean, like, I think that the way that we would look at it now is, were you involved in a closed alpha? Were you brought into a game at its, late alpha stage?
And what kind of feedback did you provide? And what did you learn?
Exactly.
And all that,
what did you learn?
Show me that report.
Exactly, right? Like, just make it worth their while. It's like, that's
totally
a video game that I play. But there's lots of things that you can do with it to make it stand out. So I did that, and I actually had to be interviewed twice for an entry-level contract position, and I was the only
one.
That's
unusual.
Only one, for sure, because I was going to be the only woman on that test team. And I knew it was going to be difficult, because I already knew what I was walking into, but I didn't realize, because I was super young, I didn't know what, I was like, this seems normal. I don't know why I'm answering the same questions twice, but okay. And so I did that. They hired me, and I kind of knew what had happened, because I walked in, and they were just like, it was very clear that the manager of that team had a very long chat with the 20 boys in that room, and I do say boys on purpose. They were very young. That, like, I was prepared for my arrival.
be on your best behavior or else.
Oh, it was, But what they did was they, I think they felt like they had to legitimize me. So they were like, she's a pro gamer and she could beat you all in Halo.
I mean.
And I was like.
I mean. At the time, I mean, at the time, not now, because now, extreme amounts of yikes. But at the time, I mean, you gotta do what you gotta do in order to get them to sit up and pay attention and not be toxic pains in the you-know-what.
That's true, yeah. It just set me up for, like, this, like, moment where I was like, oh my god, now I have to be really good.
And you have to beat them all at Halo. Like, that was that should be, like, your first order of business is line them up and smack them all down in Halo. And then you've asserted your dominance, and away you go.
And it sucks that you would have to jump through those hoops.
Yeah, it's... It does.
None of them had to do that.
No, but, definitely not.
I knew what I was walking into.
Right.
And getting myself into it. It was going to be hard. And I knew that it was... Yeah, I just knew. So it sucks that I had to go through that, but it was also...
Agreed.
So, do I want this job or not? You know, and so I was our shift was 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. because we were a build verification test team. So before the developers would come in for the day, our job was to just smoke test the build that was cooking overnight, because if there was like a blocking issue that would block the developers from being able to continue doing their work, then they needed to know before those folks kind of came in. And so it was like the bottom of the barrel, you know, job. And they even put us in this like side room. We weren't even allowed to be a part of like the full like dev team.
Oh,
So it was quite special. It was very dark in there. We all shared one computer to log bugs. We had our own dev kit, but we weren't allowed to like have our own computer. It was really funny.
What?
Oh, wow. Now, was that just a resource issue or was that a security issue?
I think it was both. But it was Bungie, like Microsoft, you know, they worked at Microsoft at the time. So I think it was more of a security issue, but I wouldn't really know for sure. We all ended up like getting our own PCs at some point. And that is not the case at all anymore. Bungie is not like that at all. It's a different place. So yeah, I spent, a shift Halo 3. That was really tough, for me. I went through a lot of challenges during that time. A lot of crap. It was not a nice place to work, being a woman.
So you shipped Halo 3. It was really challenging because you were the only woman in QA. You were a contract worker and bad. Even though Bungie, as everybody knows, isn't like that anymore.
Yes, yeah. They've changed a lot for the better, and I think I think that like I had some of the influence on that, you know, so and that's
something to be proud of.
That's a good thing. Yeah. So anyway, I worked because they were part of Microsoft at the time. So kind of like naturally at the time, if you kind of shipped a game, then you would like go on to the next one. And so transferred from Bungie over to like Xbox Game Studios. I think it was like Microsoft Game Studios at the time.
Yeah.
Became a part of their publishing test team, contractor still. And so I worked for them for about 4 years, loved working on those games. The last game I shipped there was Gears of War Judgment.
Oh, yeah.
Super fun game to work. That was a fun one.
I liked Judgment. It depends on how you play that game. If you pick all of the more difficult stuff, which takes narrative elements and puts them into the gameplay, especially towards the end when the team's getting tired and low on ammo and all that stuff. I like that game. Yeah. I am forever a Judgment apologist.
I like to say, like, I don't really know why that game got made, but I still really enjoyed working on it.
I'm proud of it. Because Baird needed his time in the spotlight.
It's also a Baird like, game? Oh man, I gotta play that.
Yeah.
He's my favorite.
It's a good one. Like, I don't know. But again, like, did it need to be made? I don't know.
The age-old question. Did this really need to get made?
I wasn't allowed to work on any of the Gears games. They would not put women on that test team for all of those years. And I came from Halo, so I was like, hello, I want to work on Gears of War. And they're like, no, you're going to work on Lost Odyssey. You're going to work on this karaoke game. You know, I'm like, man, I really just want to work on this shooter game that I really like to play. And finally, Gears Judgment is the one that I get, which is pretty hilarious. But hey, I took it all in. I was here for it. After that, I actually went to PopCap, which was a dream of mine as well. Mm. I loved PopCap games. Huge
fan. A great team, too. What a great team of people.
Wonderful people. Like, just quirky. And I love them. Mm-hmm. And work on Peggle 2, which is my favorite game I've worked on to this day. Hopefully that changes. You know, I think Disintegration might change that. But Peggle 2 was a jam. I was the QA lead when I got hired, and when I left PopCap, I was the I was the lead producer on Peggle 2 and the QA manager at PopCap, a QA manager at PopCap.
Wow.
But never got the credit for being the producer. Didn't have the actual title of being producer. I actually did get credit for it, but so it was a wild. That was a wild time.
I mean, that game, even from the moment it was announced.
Oh, yeah, that announcement was epic. Oh, so
it's pretty great.
Good. It was a dream to work on that game. One of my favorite things about talking about Peggle 2 is that Peggle, you know, that development cycle, and I got there at the end. It had been going for years before I got there. It was so difficult to make that game. That dev team had gone through so much. Tears, sweat, people, people quitting, people getting laid off. Just that was, I felt people off the make a game unicorn that was necessary. I think that's one of the coolest things game developers realize that brings so much joy and seems so simple to make are not all, you know, and they can really ruin people if you don't have the right team. Mm-hmm. So game so much because it was so hard, and then. And then it was like, it brought so much joy. So that was like really fun. So then I went to, after that, I decided I wanted to try working at an indie studio. And I followed Alan Murray, who is now the VP of production at Private Division. But I met Alan, you know, playing Halo 2 back in the day.
Nice. Everything comes back to Halo.
Yeah. I met Alan playing Halo 2, and he's the reason why I joined PopCap. And then he started an indie studio called Adam Jack, and they were making a Metroidvania codename Wayward at the time. And there's quite a few PopCap people that followed him over there. There's about 10 to 12 people in total on that team.
Wow.
And he hired me as his producer on that team. And that was a super cool opportunity for me to go full indie after being a part of like really big companies and really big games. And unfortunately, he had to shut down the studio because the game, you know, lost funding, which was for me actually a really good experience because we had a publisher and then we lost funding and then he had to shut down the studio. So when we disbanded, which was very graceful actually, because Alan did such a good job of keeping us informed of what was happening. Mm-hmm. It was not a surprise. I mean, it was a surprise that, you know, we lost funding, but, he told us right away and then had a plan, and brought us along. If we wanted to, we got to make choices at the right time. So it was a really crappy situation, but I think it was the best experience that, you know, for all of us that it could have been. So forever grateful for that experience.
It's always good to hear stories about good management.
Yeah, seriously. Right? Especially around layoffs and studio closures. Mike and I have covered studio closures and layoffs for years now, and all we ever hear are the horror stories.
Yes. And they're, I mean, and I'm not trying to say that this was great.
No, of course not.
It's not nice, because it is awful.
But it was handled with care and with you know, compassion, which is really important.
Yes, I think he did. I think he did the best that he could, and that I really appreciated that.
Mm-hmm.
So we disbanded, and I went to Valve, he started at Take-Two. And he told me about it. He was like, hey, you know, I'm starting this new thing at Take-Two. It's, like, really weird, and they're starting this new sort of, like, indie label. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like it's not going to work out.
Meanwhile.
I'm at Valve, so you call me in a year and let me know how you're doing, which is exactly what he did. He was like, this thing is actually taking off and getting funded, and I want you to come over. And I was like, sweet. So I actually left Valve to go start with him. So I was the second employee that was hired for Private Division. It wasn't Private Division at the time. I think we were called, like, Take Two Indies, internally. And so, yeah, so that's how we started this, which was super fun. So, yeah, everything all leads back to Halo. Even Disintegration leads back to Halo.
Yeah,
everything leads back to Halo. That's the new title of this episode.
Yep. I think we got it.
Super accurate.
Everything leads back to Halo. So I wanna dig deeper on QA. Your origin story, by the way, hearing it a second time is my favorite. Like,
yay.
Oh, I love it. I just love this origin story so much. You've had such an incredible career, and you have kicked so much booty throughout your career, like overcoming so much adversity, and like it's so inspirational. And anyone that's listening to this that is thinking, like, you know, this industry is not for me, man, this industry really can be for you. You just gotta fight through some of the muck to get there.
You do. And, you know, that I'm trying to change that, too. I mean, I'm not going to be able to change the whole industry, but really just trying to change that for the future, because it did not have to be that difficult.
No, it definitely did not. But let's talk about some of the changes that you have enacted. And the first place that I want to look at is QA, because that's how you came into the industry, truly came into the industry. And QA always gets a raw deal whenever we talk about the different aspects of game development, because everybody wants to, you know, lift up game design and narrative and animation and programming and everything like that. But talk to us about why QA is so important. You know, what that work is like and what life would be like without QA.
Yeah. I could talk about this for days. I'm going to try and keep it short, but still good. I love being a part of QA. I'm still a part of it. I started the and managed the Private Division QA organization along with my lead producer, you know, job, which I choose and love. And I think it's I don't think I'll ever let it go because I just care about it so much. I probably should, but you know, whatever. Many hats. Since I started in QA, you know, that's not just the reason why I love it, but it can be so much more than what people think it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it really takes good leadership, good culture, and good people. And so, you know, there are plenty of legitimate, you know, comments and situations out there where QA is not treated well.
Yeah.
But there are also instances where that is not the truth, and really it takes a lot of effort, but it is 100% worth it. So, you know, I truly believe that QA is it can be an entry to you know, the job of your dreams in the industry, but it can also be a lifelong, wonderful, really lucrative career if you know what you're doing, you have the right team, and you're at the right company. Or if you build it yourself.
As you did.
And I really, really believe that, because I would not be where I am without my experience in QA. It touches every single part of the game, of game development.
Mm-hmm.
You don't necessarily work on all of those things at the same time, but if you have a career in QA, you get to touch all of those things. And you get to understand game development as a whole. And be a part of
that.
All of that. Like, it's so important. And if you have an amazing QA team, and you also share in that vision, because all the disciplines have to share in that vision in order for it to really work. So what we call that in the at least in the Seattle area, we call that test-driven development. So Bungie is a test-driven studio. Everything actually revolves around tests, because if something is broken, then no one can do their job.
Yeah.
And so they, and there's a lot of moving parts. When you have 700 people working in the same code, you really have to make sure it works.
Man.
And if you break something, you could potentially have people lose an entire day or more of work, right? So that's not what you want to do. So it has to be test-driven in order for it to function properly. Mm-hmm. And so if you're test-driven, it means that you, and by proxy, I think you respect the test team as a super important part of the game development process. It's a discipline that really matters and yes. is respected. And so when you have a case like that where any discipline, it doesn't even have to be QA, but any discipline is respected on that same level, mm-hmm. then those people, shocker, want to stick around and do a great job.
Yeah.
Care True. About their career and their paths and yeah. their that they work with. And if they see a path forward that doesn't lead them to a glass ceiling, then they want to be better. You know, and you're going to naturally get people that are unicorns, that are, you know, really driven, want to learn more. And so, you know, if you set up an environment like that, I really believe that you're going to be successful. And I that can be copied and pasted to any discipline, really.
Sure. But I think that that's an important note is that, you know, in Dan Pink's book Drive, he talks about the three things that people need in their work in order to be productive, and that's purpose, mastery, and autonomy. And if you're able to give your people an environment that allows them to flourish and thrive like that, yeah, I mean, it can be copy and pasted yes. to any number of disciplines, but QA is the literal backbone yes. of every studio. Even if every studio isn't outright acknowledging it, QA is one of the most important pieces of a development project, period. And I'm yeah. not just talking about games, I'm talking about software.
Yeah, for sure. And anyone who doesn't think that that is the case, I think they don't realize what that potential could be, because yeah. it could be so much better if you know, if you open those doors for those folks.
Totally.
They're only going to be better at their job. It cannot go wrong. Like, what can go wrong there, right?
So, mm-hmm.
So yeah, I built the private division QA, you know, organization around that idea. We had some pillars. I don't manage it day to day, but the QA manager, Anthony Price, who I hired 2 years ago, he works with them day to day. Their office is in Las Vegas. And what I did was I met with him when we first sat down and when I first hired him, and I said, okay, here's the pillars that I see for the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a conversation, not a like direction, but a conversation with him. And you know, I wanted the QA team to be a respected discipline in our publishing organization, and also to our developers, third party or otherwise. And I wanted them to be experts in their field, but I knew that they couldn't start there because we had to hire entry level positions, and that's okay. And I also wanted to be a diverse studio because
yes.
there are diverse people play video games. And
yes.
if you have only one type of person testing your game, then you are not going to test it properly. Mm. So I really wanted that to be a pillar of the studio, and he actually was able to kind of take that and run with it, which I was super grateful for, and I knew that's why we were going to have a good partnership. So, and we're working on all of those things, which is awesome.
That's excellent. That's
yeah.
really, really wonderful. So you talked about hiring entry-level people, and mm-hmm. obviously, and I love the perspective of, you know, you're not going to have someone come in to a new job, something they've never done before, and be an expert. To me, that says there's a willingness there to train and help people grow, mm-hmm. which is also really wonderful, especially yeah. in an environment like game development, which is so high pressure.
And it's very fast paced.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. So like my theory, and I believe it's true, but you're still trying to kind of prove that out with data. My theory is that when you have an opportunity to hire entry-level people, and that's in any discipline, but for me, my expertise is in QA. So I know what it takes to kind of like hire those entry-level people, like kind of what to look for.
Mm-hmm.
But if your investment in a discipline like QA, and of course, this depends on what type of QA. So we specifically do publisher QA, and it's like black box testing, and it's not embedded development QA.
Mm-hmm.
That
okay.
is a different type of
yeah.
different type of tester, and that does take more expertise. So not that you can't hire that person entry level, but it is a different type of person and a role. And that, and so, you know, it's a little bit easier for me to hire like really entry level testers in my situation. So that's awesome. And so I take advantage of that. My theory is that it takes one game cycle for them to become an expert. And that could be potentially 2 years, 1 to 2 years, maybe three, because they don't come in at the very beginning. They usually come in a little bit later around alpha.
Sure.
And so that's 1 to 2 years. That's it. And then they're an expert in their field. And then they only become better after that. Well, who wouldn't just spend, it takes like 6 months to get ramped up in a new job in a new company for anyone who even is an expert at that point. So what, why, like to me, that's time well worth spent.
Oh, definitely. You
know, because after I shipped Halo 3, I was a badass already. So I was like, if I can, and I was an embedded tester, but still, like, I knew what I was doing after I shipped Halo 3. And it wasn't even a year that I was on it total. So I was like, why wouldn't I just replicate this here? Like, and I, now I have a team full of people who have shipped 1 to 2 titles already in 2 years.
That's great.
That's incredible mastery right there. Mm-hmm. Scattered throughout your team.
Yeah.
So you've set up this amazing QA operation at the, and this is just, again, to make it clear for our listeners who don't know, you know, this is a publisher QA operation. So they are testing multiple titles, correct? At what point in the process did they come in?
Yeah. So in the beginning, I had them coming in the beginning is like 2 years, a year and a half ago, 2 years. So it wasn't that long ago, but that was when we first started working on our new IP, really working on our new IP. And so I had them coming in about a month before our alpha milestones, which are code complete.
Okay.
And so still pretty rough, but you kind of know what you're making now.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
And the reason why we do that, we did that is because the publisher QA team can provide some testing, but they can't really do much when they're not embedded in the dev team, like on site, until they really can get their hands on something that's playable, that often. So something that's stable and playable and isn't changing like every hour.
Sure.
So because mostly around like infrastructure and hardware and things like that, a little bit difficult.
Right.
Much easier to do in-house. So a lot of the dev teams have in-house embedded testers. Not very many, but they have enough to kind of help them, you know, with their day-to-day. So our testers don't help with day-to-day until we get to that point. So what we did was, you know, like they have something kind of substantial at, around alpha, and so then they kind of start then. Now we've actually kind of shifted to getting them involved much earlier, but not everybody. So not the entire test team that would be assigned to that title. We would kind of like assign a lead, similar to we would assign a producer and a marketing lead to the team. We also assign a QA lead, potential QA lead.
Mm-hmm.
And so they start to they basically just join the conversation so that they get to know the developers.
Mm-hmm. I like
start
that.
A relationship with them. Yep. Super, super important. That doesn't happen very often, especially on the publishing side. A lot of times the testers don't even get to talk to the devs. So yeah, that's a whole other thing. I don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then also just kind of get to know the project, even though it's in its sort of concept phase. And so we're starting to do that now more because it's a little bit easier for us because we have a process going now. In the beginning, it was like, what is happening? What do we do? So so I'm super excited to see how that works out for us.
Yeah, I am too, because this is such it's an ambitious endeavor, but it is so, so interesting. It's a wonderful way to handle such an important process like QA. But let's shift gears, because I want to talk about your role as lead producer on Disintegration. And we want to dig into how your role has evolved and shifted over the course of Disintegration's development cycle, specifically Disintegration, but we can talk about broader perspectives as a lead producer. And what is it like right now, two weeks, three weeks before launch? Like, wow.
You just panicked her.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I have to look. Three weeks.
It's three weeks. Okay.
Yeah.
D- Do not shave 33% of her remaining time.
I'm sorry. I'm not trying to panic anybody. I just really want this game.
Me too. I'm stoked for it. So yeah, so I am the lead producer on Disintegration. I work directly with B1 Interactive, and all things lead back to Halo.
They do.
We actually signed V1 Interactive because Alan and I had worked with Marcus and a lot of his crew on Halo together. So that that was a really cool opportunity. I'm really proud of that. So I started working on this game just a little bit over 4 years ago. So that's been super fun. So it's been a journey.
Let's start at almost the beginning.
Almost the beginning, yeah. So V1 was just starting to build out their studio. They didn't have very many people. I can't remember how many. I want to say about 10 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
Alan and I were going over there and visiting them because they're actually pretty close to my house. I live about an hour away from the office. From our private division office, but I live close to V1. So it was actually kind of nice. It's been nice for me to be able to like just go there in between trips to the office. So
makes sense.
We spent a lot of time hanging out with them in person, and you know, like we knew each other, but getting to know each other from a business perspective was really interesting and fun. Where it was like kind of this weird dynamic where, you know, we're their publisher, but we're also like their friends. And it was an adjustment for both of us. We're like, you don't have to announce to the studio that we're walking in the office. I think I would feel the same way if I were in their shoes. They were just like, how do we act around you? And we're like, please just treat us like you normally would.
Please just treat us like people good.
I know, but I totally get it, right? You're just like, if you left your big AAA, quadruple A job, and then you start your own studio, and you know, even if you're friends with the people that you're working with, you know, they're still paying your bills, and how do you act around those folks? Like, I don't blame them at all. It was a fun, interesting time. But we very quickly got over that. And so, you know, we became a partnership. It was much easier for me to be a part, to get to know V1 as a third-party developer because of my history with them. We still had and have challenges because of the nature of our jobs, but has been a really rewarding experience to work with them. I love working with them. It's a dream to do this job. So I basically manage everything that I can take off of their plates. Like, essentially, I'm the liaison between the whole publishing organization, our marketing team, our PR team, our sales team, our biz dev team, QA, not so much anymore. They have their own relationship now, but at the time, and then also, you know, anything else, vendors or anything that we would, you know, bring in between, I would help manage those relationships and kind of, you know, glue everybody together. And help set them up for success. And since I have a lot of expertise in that area from my experience, you know, we're able to help them a lot more than I think some of the other studios who had already had some of that stuff established. So not all of our studios have like that infrastructure ready to go because they're starting from scratch. But some of them do. Like Obsidian, for example, is an established, well-established studio. They have people in place to do a lot of those things, like having a release management team, a QA lead with a QA team, production lead with a production team, you know, things like that.
Totally.
They know what they're doing there. But people like places like V1, they were starting from scratch and much smaller. So we helped them a lot with that stuff, gave them a lot of advice and, you know, just collaborated with them on that. So that has been like what I've been doing up until this point. And then we got really, really like, we got really collaborative around the technical beta. That was essentially like a shipped product, right? If you think about it.
Oh, definitely.
And so that was really intense because none of us had done it before by ourselves. We always had the backing of Microsoft or, you know, a team that knew how to do those things.
Right.
And we'd all done it before, but not by ourselves together. So, you know, that was a learning experience for the whole private division organization and all of E1. Mm. And so we really, really worked together hard on that one. And so I was at the studio during that entire, well, leading up to it, weeks leading up to it. This was in January, late January. And I was at the studio every single day of that beta, technical beta, in, you know, just providing support. I was like in a room, just like, I just like lived there. And it was awesome. Super fun. it was a lot of work, but it was super fun. And that was like, that was when we all started to like really become like a unit. It wasn't just like the publisher and the developer. Like, this is the whole team making this game.
That's,
what I love. That's what I prefer.
Oh, I love that. That's so wholesome.
You know,
I mean, yeah, super rewarding, right? And also much easier to do.
To be clear, so a technical beta, just to put a fine point on it again for listeners and for me. so you're focused at that point mostly on the networking, and because this is an online multiplayer mm-hmm. game, or it has a significant yeah. online multiplayer component. So this is where you're focused on testing the infrastructure that players are going to connect into when they play, for the most part, or are there other pieces of that as well?
Yeah, it was, I mean, that was the goal of that was to make sure that our networking stood up. Mm-hmm. And that we could take anything, you kind of, this is what I would say as the producer, I want it to break because I want to see what happens so that we can adjust and so that we have a plan moving forward when we launch. You know, if something does break, well, when something does break, what is the playbook? What are we going to do? Mm-hmm. You know, and how can we adjust from here? So we're never going to get like, well, we weren't able to get, we didn't expect to get like launch numbers, but it's okay. We just needed a sample in order to, you know, have that playbook ready. Mm-hmm. So it's the main goal is to make sure the networking stands up, but it's also, you know, it was a trial to ship a online multiplayer game as well,
mm-hmm.
Including marketing, including PR, including production and QA and support and developer support. And so it was this awesome, like, fully, like, it was like this sort of demo of how launch was going to go, like a little baby launch.
Yeah.
It was very intense. So it's all of that. It's like, how are we going to launch this title, even if it's just the small part of it that we're doing right now? And then the big stuff comes afterwards when we take all that kind of like the postmortem learnings
mm-hmm.
and we figure out how we're going to apply that to launch. So yeah, that was sort of like the two main goals is like, how do we launch this thing? And then does the networking stand up and how do we adjust from there?
Sure. And you said you were in the studio for this.
Yes. Yeah.
So one little change that has happened since then, and not sure if you're aware, there's this little pandemic going on.
Yes.
And it has changed the way we all live and work. How has this impacted, especially from your role as being the liaison between the studio and the publishing operation at Private Division, how has it impacted your work specifically and the way everything has come together? Because you guys were trucking towards the finish line when all this hit.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I'm assuming a lot of people know this, but, you know, if you don't know, you know, the game is starting to finish, like, you know, at least a couple months, if not more, before launch, typically. Mm-hmm. It depends on the game and what, you know, if it's digital only or whatnot, or, you know, what's going on with it. But, you know, we don't finish the game in the last 3 weeks of mm-hmm. the, you know, before launch. So we were definitely, you know, heading towards the finish line there. We were right in the middle of it, actually. So that was rough. Like, I'm not gonna sugarcoat this. This is really, really tough for everybody on top of the emotional part of this.
Yes.
It was super difficult to change the way an entire company works from home and stay safe and working with another company that is also doing the same thing and with multiple remote locations. You know, we have our team in New York, we have our team mm-hmm. in Las Vegas here. And then, you know, just, it was really tough and it was extremely stressful. But all of us were very determined to just make sure everyone was safe and healthy and comfortable, which I think was hard at first, but it's starting to get a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
So we shut down the studios at the same time, which I think helped. Mm-hmm. Once Private Division in Seattle was like no longer going into the office, V1 was, it was the same day. They were like, we are also shutting down. And we talked with them too. They asked us, you know, what our plan was, and we shared that with them. And they basically did the same, but they made their own decision, but they did the same thing. And so the hardest part was, I think, making sure we set up a communication cadence, even though I still technically work remote, you know, with V1. Like we said, we were, you know, I went into the office pretty often, especially when things are like really heated, like everything's on fire, it is so much better to have conversations in person. Mm-hmm. So any time, like, not necessarily people were mad at each other, but you know, when you could tell that things are getting a little crazy, I would go into the office and like, hey, I'm going to sit down with you in person and we're going to talk about this, you know? And so I lost that, which was unfortunate. But instead what we did was we communicate more often online and we have video calls more often. And that happened pretty quickly, and we just upped the cadence of that. Normally, we kind of try to let... I don't know how to explain this. I try to leave them alone. Like, I don't need to be, you know, just bothering them all the time. Mm-hmm. They got to do their work.
Yeah, you know? Of course. So there's no point in micromanaging.
Yeah. And as a publishing producer, I'm very sensitive to that because I know what it's like to be on the other side. So, anyway,
for sure.
That all went out the window, you know. So, now we're all bothering each other. So, and then equipment and infrastructure was so difficult.
Probably the most
difficult thing that we did. Yeah. So, you know, not everybody has space in their homes or apartments for full gaming rigs plus dev kits. Also the dev kits are difficult because some of the, first party requirements are very secure.
Mm-hmm.
And requires, you know, IP configurations and all this stuff, all the security stuff, was a huge hurdle. And things were changing, and I'm sure you folks, you know, experienced the same thing, in your lives, but things were changing every 6 to 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was so hard to keep up with that. Like, I can deal with things changing every week.
Sure.
You know, and having kind of a heads up, but things were changing so quickly that I was like, I don't know what we're going to be doing tomorrow. Like, I don't know how this is going to work out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you all are in an epicenter of COVID infection, and we're also in North Jersey in an epicenter of infection. So like, we 100% get this, where everything was changing every 6 to 12 hours, where it was very difficult to keep up with anything work related, let alone keeping our own mental health in a place where we could function as, I don't know, human beings.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Other than the equipment and infrastructure, emotions, and mental health, and making sure everyone was safe and healthy was so, so tough.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think a lot of us got lucky, thankfully. It was a lot to do.
Yeah.
And you know, a big, big ups and major shout outs to all the IT teams out there.
Oh yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. Wow.
Heroes in our industry. Heroes in our industry, because wow, they really came through, and they continue to do it with, you know, with no complaints, at least to us. I hope that they complain to each other, because I would. but they were just like, they got us through this. So, and remotely, they did it remotely, because a lot of us don't have IT folks like in-house. So it was really awesome to see that. And then getting the equipment to us was really difficult. Still continues to be difficult, but it's not as bad. And PDQA, my Private Division QA team, that was actually one of the hardest ones that we had to figure out, because they work in a building that is secure.
Mm-hmm.
And is set up for testing, and none of that is set up for home a home situation.
I would imagine not.
I can do my job, maybe 70% of my job, on my phone because I travel a lot and I go between studios and I work remotely with people. But that is not how QA works.
No.
There's a lot of equipment.
Yes.
So that took a lot of effort, a lot of coordination, but we really, they blew me away. They really adjusted well to that, to that situation, and we were able to get, to get V1 that support, because this is the time when they need it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We can't ship without them looking at the bill.
No.
I was like, how do I make sure V1 has all of the, has everything that they need to do their jobs? And also, how do I make sure that the QA team can test the game to get it ready for certification for first party, like Sony and Microsoft?
Mm-hmm.
We also weren't sure how that was going to work. We weren't sure if we'd be able to submit our builds. We
sure.
haven't been able to, of course, mm-hmm. but at the time, again, we didn't know, people were like, Carrie, how long is this going to take when we think we can actually ship? And I'm like, I really do not know how to tell you.
No answers.
I've never done this before.
Yeah, that's been such a hard part of it, is the big unknowns on top of the normal unknowns.
Yes, yes. And I really, at this point, I keep telling people, I'm like, I'm about to ship a game from my living room during a global pandemic.
There's an achievement for that.
I'm pretty sure you get an Xbox achievement for that.
How could we have expected this? I never thought I would ship a game from my living room, so let alone during a pandemic. So, wow.
That is going to be one heck of a Zoom call.
Yeah, everybody's going to be popping the champers.
Yep.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, we were trying to do stuff like that, too. Like, we usually have, a toast. It is usually a virtual toast, but we have a toast with our teams when they submit and pass certification, because it's a huge, huge deal.
Oh,
and we have to
it's gnarly.
Moments with each other. Yeah, so, we're trying to figure out how to do that from home, which we have. Thankfully, we have things like Zoom and whatnot. But yeah, it's like all that stuff really matters. And you like all of that is kind of like taken away. So we're still trying to manage that. But now we have, where things aren't changing every 6 to 12 hours. We're able to kind of stick to our schedules for the most part. Things pop up. Things have been popping up. But I think that everyone has done such a good job of making sure that everyone's in communication. It's just communication.
Mm-hmm.
Only way where any of us are going to get through this. And it is the reason why we're able to get through this, and also kind of letting a lot of things go that you normally wouldn't. So for example, we share a lot more information, I think, with each other, and where we didn't think that was maybe necessary before. But I think it is necessary now. And that has really helped. So being transparent, more transparent than normal, and also being vulnerable with each other has really helped
so important.
Me. Because, just because we're all sitting at home doesn't mean that life doesn't suck sometimes. And so that has been, nice, crappy to have to go through, but nice.
At least you're not alone. And this game looks incredible. Mike and I had a chance to check it out, a couple times now?
Yeah, at PAX.
At PAX a couple of times.
Oh, yes.
So we're really excited for the launch. So Disintegration, again, developed by V1 Interactive, published by Private Division, is out super, super soon. It's coming out on PC, Xbox One, PlayStation 4 on June 16th.
Yes.
Holy moly. I'm so excited. This game looks incredible. It was basically made for me.
Yay, that's so exciting. I think you're really going to like it.
I am so excited by what I saw already. For folks that haven't seen much of Disintegration, it's this incredible amalgamation of a first-person shooter meets a tactical real-time strategy game. It was made for me. It is a game that says, "Hi, Amanda, this is made for you."
And it has robots.
Robots!
There we go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Robots.
I am excited for you to kick my butt in this.
Robot booty.
Yeah, I am 100% going to kick your booty in this, Mike.
I know.
I'm so excited about it. All right. Carrie, thank you so much for sitting with us and chatting with us about your illustrious career. Holy moly, we made it through episode 23?
I think it's 23.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Man, we did it.
It's a good number.
It is. It's a great number. I like that number.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. This is fun.
Thank you. So yeah, thanks everybody for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Virtual Econcast. I am at Footerish, F-U-T-T-E-R-I-S-H.
And I'm at Amanda Farrow.
And Carrie, where can people find you online?
Oh, I'm at the Don Juan, which is my old gamer tag.
I love it.
It's so good.
I love it.
You can subscribe to our RSS feed if this is your very first time to Virtual Economy. We are on Libsyn, so that's virtualeconomy.libsyn. That's LIBSYN.com/RSS. You can also listen to us on all major podcasting platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, Pocket Cast. I don't know, I ran out of things to say. The most important thing that you can do for us, if you really do like our show, the best way to support us right now is to hit the subscribe button, because that lets the algorithm gods know that we are worth paying attention to. Maybe one day they'll put us on the front page of whatever topic of conversation that we're actually categorized under. Actually, I don't
business.
Remember.
Business.
Is it actually
and
in business?
Video games. Yeah.
Yeah, it's under business and video games. Go us.
Yeah, and if you have any questions for us or our guests, you can DM us at Virtual Econcast or shoot us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz. Virtual Economy is an F-Squared initiative, and along with our pro bono business consulting for up-and-coming developers, it's a way we're working to give back to the community. To find out more about F-Squared and the services we can provide, including pitch prep, media training, mock reviews, and business strategy guidance, you can visit our website at fsquared.biz. Amanda's laughing because I usually spell it, and I'm not gonna.
Ah! He robbed me of it.
FSQUARED.biz.
Every time, it's so funny. I don't know why it's funny, but it is. So just like, give me this one. Just be cool. Just be cool. All right. We will be back very soon. And in the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.